Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Arturo Lopez Levy, who's a former analyst for the Cuban government, now a lecturer at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's also a research associate of the Institute for the Study of Israel in the Middle East and teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics at the University of Denver and the Colorado School of Mines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arturo Lopez Levy.
It's a great pleasure, Ian.
So you were quoted in Monday's New York Times in regard to what happened on Sunday in Cuba, where Raul Castro, the current president and the brother of the former president going back to 1959, he announced that he will step down after beginning this five-year term, which will mean that he will step down in 2018. He's now 81, so he'll be 86, which is the same age as his older brother, Fidel, right?
Yes, what his older brother is now.
Right. So you're quoted as suggesting here that the person that it's, well, we don't know whether he's anointed and he's the likely successor, but Mr. Díaz-Canel is widely seen in Cuba as a technocrat, a regional czar whose power is discreet but tangible, who earned Mr. Castro's favor not only with youth and loyalty, but also by being a good manager. Now, that's your quote. So could you just elaborate on what it is about this relatively young fellow who may or may not be the president of Cuba in 2018 or 2019?
Well, according to the institutional mechanism of succession, this man is now, Miguel Díaz-Canel is online to succeed Raúl Castro in 2018. This is a very interesting moment in Cuban history because two major problems or two major dimensions overlap. The first one is a matter of juncture. Raúl Castro, as you mentioned, is quite old, and obviously there is a need for a new leader to succeed him in 2018. On the other hand, Raúl Castro, when he succeeded his brother Fidel, he began to develop a parallel process of economic reform and political liberalization that include the institutionalization of one-party rule. As part of the institutionalization process, there is a more predictable way to for the promotion of communist party leaders, and in this sense, what we have seen is a renewal of the Council of Ministers. That basically, most of the ministers from the time of Fidel Castro was the president has been replaced in the last 5 years. Almost 60% of the Council of State was renewed in this session of the National Assembly, in this type of elections, that they are one-party elections in Cuba. And in the case of Mr. Díaz-Canel, he has been promoted step by step, not in a kind of Fidelista type of promotion, that it was a kind of helicopter, because Fidel Castro will choose some young leaders and he will promote them to a high level of the party. In this case, is a leader who has a long record of serving the party in two strategic provinces in which he has implemented or managed some of the main economic reforms, and also has built a significant network of power connections with other provincial czars of the party apparatus, and also with the upper level and medium upper level command of the armed forces.
But it seems to me, Arturo Lopez Levy, that at least there appears to be a contradiction when you say that Raul Castro has been responsible for some economic reforms. At the same time, he's institutionalized more power inside the Communist Party. And apparently, in terms of if Mr. Díaz-Canel is his protege, apparently, according to your quote in Monday's New York Times, that Mr. Díaz-Canel has worked as an intermediary between the central government and the military, and apparently the military are getting into the tourism business. So explain that paradox.
Well, I don't. The paradox appear if you believe that somebody that is in favor of economic reform, he will be in favor of a kind of multi-partidism. But this is not the case. The project of the Communist Party under Raúl is to open the economy, liberalize the relationship, or opening also the relationship between Cuba and its diaspora, between Cuba and the rest of the world. But there is no project to beginning a process of democratization. So in this case, what you have is that this leader is someone, Miguel Díaz-Canel, is someone with experience in the party apparatus, and at the same time he has been promoting the type of reforms that are connected with this project of opening some space for the market, creating a kind of mixed economy. And in this sense, basically, he has to deal with the reality that the armed forces are a major actor in Cuban politics today.
So is this some form of patronage then, getting them into the tourism business?
No, it's that for quite a long time, the Cuban armed forces in the 1990s assume the responsibility of managing many economic activities because all the military budget was very affected by the disappearance of the Soviet Union. Therefore, beginning in the 90s, there was an expansion of economic or of military economic companies that enter into the tourist business and other areas like agriculture, some kind of partnership for industrial products, industrial goods. That was the something that happened in the during the 90s, and the process deepened during the years, the first presidential mandate of Raúl Castro.
Again, I'm speaking with Arturo López Levy, who's a former analyst for the Cuban government, now a lecturer at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Well, in terms of the paradox that I posed and you said, well, only if you see this as a kind of move towards capitalism, I guess you're implying. I think Raúl Castro, in his speech on Sunday, made that pretty clear, did he not? He said, "I was not chosen to be president to restore capitalism to Cuba. I was elected to defend, maintain, and continue to perfect socialism, not destroy it."
That was what he said.
Yes. So in terms of what I understand about the reforms that Raúl Castro is responsible for in his tenure so far, he's lifted the ban on mobile phones and home computers, and he's taken away the restriction for citizens to buy expensive exit visas when traveling abroad as tourists. Anything you can add to that list?
Yes, a lot. They have a law of cooperatives or cooperatives that basically allowed the creation of this type of property in which people shared profits and responsibilities, but it's not state-owned companies. They also established that legislation for bankruptcy and also for contracts between the state-owned companies and the non-state sector, something that is very different from what was happening in the early 90s when Cuba only allowed some islands of capitalism or market-oriented areas in a sea of command economy. Now, basically, they have a model in which the two parts are integrated. Also, there has been a fiscal reform in which there are incentives, but also new taxes. The Cubans who used to have a system of implicit taxation, now they will have to pay taxes, and at the same time, they will be able to own private business that now are bigger in scale. There is also, as you mentioned, the issue of the migratory reform by which Cubans now are allowed, basically most of the Cubans, with some important exception, mainly military and people that are in areas such as the health sector, and some people specifically, most of the people are allowed now to travel abroad.
Well, Arturo López-Levy, apparently Mr. Díaz-Canel, who's is next in line in 2018, but of course I think it's widely understood that that's not necessarily means that he will assume the presidency and replace Raul Castro, but it certainly puts him at the head of the pack, if you will. He's apparently recently played a very important role in meeting with officials from Venezuela. Yes. Cuba's most important ally, of course, and Venezuela supplies Cuba with oil. And, of course, throughout this period, you've had Hugo Chavez being treated in Cuba. This has created a peculiar backlash in Venezuela. I was speaking to some reporters down there the other day, and apparently a group, 21 Venezuelan students, chained themselves in front of the Cuban embassy in Caracas in protest to the secrecy and the overwhelming, if you will, role of the Castro brothers in their affairs. But of course, this all, I take it, comes from the fact that Hugo Chavez sees Fidel Castro as a kind of father figure. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that Mr. Díaz-Canel has close relationships with the Venezuelan leadership, like most of the Cuban leadership has. He has been very involved. He was the Minister of Higher Education, and Cuba is involved in some programs to develop some universities, new universities or medical schools and other things of this kind in Venezuela. And obviously, Mr. Díaz-Canel played an important role in this area. I don't think that in there is any particularly special that made him closer to the Venezuelans than the rest of the Cuban elite. His presence in the ceremony to kind of inaugurate the new presidential term of President Chavez when Chavez still was in Havana, he was the one who represented the Cuban government for a simple reason. It's part of the promotion of Mr. Díaz-Canel by the Cuban leadership. He need to get some type of international experience.
So you mentioned earlier, Arturo López-Levy, when the Soviets cut off their economic and particularly their energy supplies at the end of the Cold War, the Cuban military had to adapt. How much has Venezuela filled that gap? Could you make the case that...
I think that Venezuela has been very important. Fidel Castro even claimed that Venezuela helped the Cuban Revolution to survive. But I believe that the worst years of the Cuban economy happened during the 90s, before Mr. Chavez became the president of Venezuela. So I think that, yes, the partnership with Venezuela has been strategically important, but it has not been the decisive factor in saving the Cuban economy.
I thank you very much for joining us, Arturo López-Levy.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who is a former analyst for the Cuban government. He's now a lecturer at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's also a research associate of the Institute for the Study of Israel in the Middle East and teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics at the University of Denver and the Colorado School of Mines. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.